It's truly a pleasure to be part of this extraordinary project. I always enjoy doing anything with Rabbi Kelman. He's truly a visionary in the field of Jewish education, and I'm delighted to be a part, to fly on his coattails, as they say. Rabbi Kelman, is there any other preparatory things that we need before we begin the lecture?
No, everything is fine.
Great. So I am here from the Five Towns in New York. The weather is about 35 degrees, and there's a little bit of snow on the ground, and I'm delighted to see the Torontonians. I actually, God willing, will be joining you in Toronto next week, Emir Tzashem, for, I believe it's called the Walensky Lecture at the university there. I have been charged by Rabbi Kelman to deliver a lecture in the field of Jewish medical ethics. We have an extraordinary opportunity to talk about medical ethics from the past, from the present, and into the future. Some people may erroneously believe that medical ethics is a field of the present, that perhaps with the extraordinary advances in medicine from the past few decades, that's when the field of medical ethics began. But indeed, medical ethics is as old as the halacha or the Torah itself. We have a few sessions together. I believe we have a total of four sessions together over the next few weeks, Mr. Shem, for the next four Thursdays. We will be dividing our sessions in the following way. Our session this evening will be discussing some fascinating chapters from the history of medicine and halacha to illustrate for us that the rabbis of all previous generations, much like the rabbis of today, have been abreast of the contemporaneous medical issues of their respective generations. For our second session, we will be talking about a contemporary topic. That topic is organ donation in Jewish law, and I know apropos the chat that there are sessions next Sunday, I believe, that there's the program that I'm speaking at next Sunday, and there's also a program on organ donation in Jewish law, which I know about. And interestingly, just to give you an idea of how important organ donation is, the conference this coming week in Toronto will be the fourth conference internationally on organ donation in Jewish law in the past year or two. There have been a number of full-day conferences in Eretz Yisrael. They had two- or three-day conference. At Yeshiva University, they had a day conference on organ donation. At Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where I teach and practice, they had a two-day conference on organ donation in Jewish law. So next session, we will, Mir Sashem, talk about some of the pressing issues, both in living donation and in donation after death. They're called the deceased donation or cadaveric donation. Our third topic will be, will it be Ilan or Ilana, which is good for you, Rabbi Kelman. I believe your wife's name is Ilana, is that correct?
Well, you spell it with an E instead of an I. You spend Ilan and Ilana with an E, I spell it with an I.
See, my daughter with an E. That's where it comes from. So there we'll be talking about a field which is truly extraordinary. The ramifications from the Jewish perspective we're only starting to appreciate. And the manipulation of the human genome, the understanding of the human genome and its application from a halakhic perspective are truly extraordinary. And Mir Tzashem, if I'm able through this website to share some of the material on the web, for that session, I'll share with you a site that I put together with literally hundreds of articles that deal with many aspects of infertility and reproduction and genetics, ranging from use of sperm after death, for which there was a recent case in the state of Israel, which they adjudicated about a woman, about a tragic case of a soldier in Eretz Yisrael who passed away, and his family harvested his reproductive seed, and the family requested to use that reproductive seed posthumously. And it was a court case which spanned a few months and actually was just decided over the last few weeks. To issues of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is the use of technology to take an embryo, which is still in the laboratory, and has just reached an 8-cell stage in the laboratory, and harvest but one of those cells, and use that information gleaned from that cell to determine the genetic makeup of that embryo, and then to determine whether indeed you want to implant or discard that embryo. So it has halachic ramifications for Jews, for example, who for whom both partners are carriers for Tay-Sachs disease. Or if you want to select out for gender selection, many different things like that. And our final session, in session 4, will be talking about anticipating the medical halachic problems of the future. And there we will have very interesting sessions. I'll share with you a theoretical journal called the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha, where we will venture into the 21st and 22nd centuries to discuss some of the issues which we could anticipate in the future. So, for example, we'll discuss the case of, can one woman possibly have two firstborn children that each would require a pidyon haben, and other such interesting issues as we venture into the late 21st and 22nd centuries. So as we continue our chavrusa here in Toronto, do you have the handout with you for this evening's session? As we turn the illustration on the front page of the handout, is actually a beautiful illustration, which we'll discuss the origins of that illustration in a short while. But there has been a, with respect to the human body and the understanding of the human body, which we'll discuss a little bit this evening, there has been an exhibit touring the world, and I'm not sure if it reached Toronto or not. And that's an exhibit, it's called Body Worlds, which is an exhibit which displays the human body in different ways, and the exhibit actually contains real, genuine human bodies, which have been dissected and preserved in a unique method by Gunther von Hagen in a method called plastination. It's traveled extensively throughout Europe. It's been here in the United States. I'm not sure if it's reached Canada or not, but it's an interesting halachic issue about the permissibility of using the human body for these kinds of purposes, for museums and for exhibits and for things like that. So let us now return to our handouts to discuss today's session. Now today, we're going to span a few centuries, and we're going to choose a few chapters from the history of medicine, which I hope you will find enjoyable. And we begin our chronological journey of the history of Jewish medical ethics in the 16th century. And if you turn to the second page of your handout, you find a responsum from Rav David ben Zimra from the 16th century. Rav David ben Zimra was a very prominent Egyptian rabbi who practiced in Cairo, who practiced in Alexandria, and we turn to the question that was posed to him back in the 1600s. Sha'alta mimeni, and I'm reading from the first line of this second page of the handout, Odiyacha da'ati on what basis, it was asked by David ben Zimra, do people today in the 16th century make use of a particular medicine called mumia? And they use it in circumstances which are not life-threatening. And they use it in ways which their bodies clearly directly benefit from it. V'lo'od, and furthermore, mistachrimbo v'nos'im v'nos'nimbo. They take this medicinal substance called mumia, and they trade it. They practice commerce with this particular substance. And what's the problem with this substance, mumia? The problem is, v'hu me'isurei ana, it's, according to the Torah, it should be prohibited to derive benefit. Remember why? The kaimalan debaster hameis asur b'hana, because the halacha teaches us that the flesh of a corpse is considered prohibited. So in order for us to understand the case of David ben Zimmer, we have to take a historical tangent. Let's take ourselves back to the first or second century of the Common Era, where we read about a substance called mum or mumia, which was derived from the ground. It was mined in areas in Israel near the Dead Sea. It was mined in areas in where modern-day Iraq would be. And it was a black, tarry substance called mum or mumia. The etymology is, I believe, ultimately a Persian source. This particular substance, a very thick, black, tarry substance, was thought to have wonderful medicinal value. In fact, it was a panacea. It was used for gastrointestinal diseases, for skin ailments, for a wide variety of conditions. It was thought to have such great medicinal value, in fact, that the Egyptians co-opted this material for their use in embalming. So to this very day, if you travel to museums which exhibit mummies that have been unraveled, so examples include the Metropolitan Museum here in New York, the British Museum in London, probably the second most extensive Egyptology exhibit outside Egypt is in the northern Italy in the city of Turin, or Torino. You'll see mummies that have been unraveled, and these mummies are pitch black. Now, the reason these mummies are black is not because they are desiccated from old age, but rather because they've been embalmed with this substance called mum or mumia. Now, what happened over a period of centuries is that people believed that the medicinal substance of the tar was transferred to the very body that was embalmed in that substance to such an extent that the very body itself became called a mummy. And the etymology of that term, mummy, finds its expression from the origin of this mum or mumia substance. And this transference occurred in the medical community as well, until it reached a belief, which was common in the 1500s, that the medicinal value of mum or mumia was associated with the human body that was embalmed. So they, in fact, harvested old Egyptian mummies and used extract of Egyptian mummy for medicinal purposes. And this mummy was either ingested or used as a salve, and it derived from the human body, it derived from the corpse. And who do you think was in charge of the Egyptian mummy trade back in the 1500s? The Jews. The Jews were heavy traders of this mumia substance. And so it's quite possible that in the congregation of David ben Zimra, there may have been a few individuals who were trading in this substance, not to mention the many people who were undoubtedly using this substance. And if you went to the local pharmacist, you would see a vial or a container, much like the one on your handout in the upper right-hand side of the second page, labeled Mumia Alexandria, mumia from the city of Alexandria. So when this question was asked to David ben Zimmer, David ben Zimmer's response was the same response which in essence all rabbis have had in previous centuries and all rabbis continue to have to this very day. In order to answer any question of medicine in halacha, the rabbi must educate himself in the medicine. Otherwise, the decision that you're rendered is simply not a valid decision. So that's exactly. He went to the local pharmacist and he said, "Pharmacist, I have this question. I need to know the production of mumia. How does it take place from the harvesting of the body until the time it reaches your shelf in this vial labeled Mumia Alexandria? What do you do?" So the pharmacist explained to him, "We harvest this mumia, we crush it, we add cinnamon, we add myrrh, we add a whole host of honey, and there's an extensive process which is undergone until it reaches the table of the pharmacist, which is purchased by the consumer. So given this information, Rav David ben Zimra rendered his answer. Here, as the case in many of the sources we have on our handout, it's just obviously a small excerpt. It's a very lengthy responsum. But here we have, reading from the second paragraph, Tshuva. Isser achila lo hutzrachta lishol. Devada mutar b'achila. So Rav David says, you don't have to ask me about the permissibility of ingesting this material, which ultimately derives from the human corpse. Because, Rav David ben Zimra says, it is mutter b'achila, it is permitted to eat. Why? Shahari nishtanet tzurasso v'chazor liyos ofer ba'alma. Because, and this is an important fact based on his research into the substance mumia, because it has lost its original identity. It is so far removed from the body from which it was extracted that it is not considered halachically relevant anymore. So he says it is permitted to ingest this substance even though it derives from the human corpse. Now he does add, in addition to this, a permission which is invoking a principle which is relevant to our present discussion this evening, and is also relevant to, very relevant to our discussion next week in Yirtzeh Hashem, on the issue of organ transplantation. And that is the principle of pikuach nefesh. We all know from our Jewish teachings that life takes precedence almost over everything. So therefore, if it's a question of pikuach nefesh, you're allowed to violate all the prohibitions of the Torah except the main three prohibitions, including homicide and idolatry and any illicit sexual relations. So here the Radbaz also invokes that principle that for the sake of preserving or saving human life, even if there would be prohibitions involved, you would be allowed to violate those prohibitions. And just to summarize an additional point of David ben Zimra's, while it's true, he notes, that one can ingest this material and is permitted to ingest this material, he does point out, however, that it would generate impurity or tuma if there was the requisite volume from the corpse in the material that you happen to own. And as it turns out, and here obviously in the source in the handout, the print is very small, and these other sources, my objective is not to read through these line by line, but just to show you that not only did Rav David ben Zimra address this issue of mumia, a number of others, roughly contemporary with Rav David ben Zimra, also addressed this issue of mumia, including Rav Yaakov Castro in the left-hand side of your handout, who strongly disagreed with the conclusions of Rav David ben Zimra about this substance, mumia. But he did concur with Rav David ben Zimra about the prohibition of tuma in this mumia substance. And some of the questions asked in the responsa literature of that time were asked by Kohanim whether it was permissible for a Kohen to either utilize this substance himself or to trade in this substance, which could theoretically generate the purity and impurity. And the issue is likewise addressed by the Mishnah Lamelech, a famous commentary on the Rambam on the bottom left-hand side. And on the right side of your handout, in a passage that I will just summarize for you, of Eliezer Ashkenazi from the 1500s, who was writing a parish on Chumash called Mate Avos, when he discusses the situation of Lot's wife and Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt, he actually invokes the mumia story. But he invokes it in quite an interesting and unique way. And to give a background for a moment in this parish of Eliezer Ashkenazi, we have to share with you another important fact. You could well imagine if mumia was a substance that was a popular substance in the 1500s and Jews needed to trade in this substance, mumia, how many Egyptian mummies were available? Not so easy to come by. So the supply, the demand rather, clearly exceeded the supply. So what a number of producers of mumia did is they actually took recently deceased bodies in a fraudulent practice, allowed them to desiccate in the sands of the African deserts, and used them or pawned them off as mumia. So this Matzah Hashem, the Eliezer Ashkenazi, when he talks about the pillar of salt that Lot's wife turned into, he says it's not dissimilar to these bodies that are left out in the desert, which are desiccated and dried and are used by the pharmacists to create this substance called mumia. And what is interesting is that if you look in the upper left-hand corner of your handout, you'll see an illustration of another vial, another container of mumia. And this container of mumia is labeled slightly differently. It doesn't say the location of the mumia. It's labeled as mumia ver. Mumia ver means genuine certified mummy, not to be confused with the fraudulent mummy which was being conned off by some other distributors. So if you will, there perhaps could have been a hashgacha, you know, the OU would have been on this one, or the chaske would have been on this one. But this was considered to be the genuine certified mumia as opposed to the other type of mumia. So what happened ultimately to this trade, this mumia trade, is there was a disgruntled employee, you know, at scandals not dissimilar to the scandals here in the 20th and 21st century. There was a disgruntled employee of one of the Jewish factory owners for mumia, and he went to the king and told the king of Egypt that his employer was using fraudulent mummies and not using the true original mumia. So when the king found out about this fraudulent practice, he imposed an extraordinary tax on the mummy trade, and this exploded the mummy trade, which very rapidly dissipated thereafter. That is why the bulk of the responsa literature on this mumia issue appears in the 1500s and 1600s, maybe a little bit in the early 1700s, but you won't see anything about it thereafter. Just to close the chapter of mumia, I was once giving a lecture in south of Florida, in Jacksonville, and a woman from Uzbekistan came up to me afterwards, and she said, I want you to know, doctor, that my husband, when I came from Uzbekistan, my husband fell ill shortly after, and I went to all the American doctors, and none of the doctors were able to help him. So I sent back to my country, to Uzbekistan, for mumia, for a bottle of mumia. This mumia, which we've been using for, she said, since she was a child that she remembers, it's in tablet form. You can actually see on your handout in the bottom left hand, she sent me some mumia tablets. And you notice the color, I don't know if you can see it on your handout, the tablets are pitch black, just like the original mumia from 2 millennia ago. And she told me that her husband was completely cured once he started taking these mumia tablets, and that nobody in America could find a diagnosis or cure for his disease. And then she came to me after the lecture and she said, maybe you'd like to go into dealings together, maybe we can bring this mumia stuff to the United States and sell it. So suffice it to say that I haven't done that yet, but it attests to the longevity of this issue of mumia. And we now leave the 16th century after addressing what was for then a very pressing, real, and contemporary medical halakhic problem. And the take-home point here is the fact that Rav David Ben Zimmer employed the methodology which we will find time and time again in the field of medical halakha. Educate yourself in the scientific and medical facts, and then render the decision accordingly. We now shift into the 17th and 18th century to address as we turn the page to the page labeled The Anatomy of Halakha, where we address a question that was posed to Rabbi Chezkel Landau, known by the pseudonym the Nod of Yehuda. The question may be familiar to some of you, especially those in the medical field. It is a seminal question, a seminal responsum, quoted to this very day, and it actually is invoked extensively in the field of organ donation and transplantation. But our focus this evening will be on the historical underpinnings of this responsum, focusing more on the halakhic ramifications next week. So reading from the responsum on the top of the page, from the second line, Mr. Landau, from the community in London. Now, he was a he found himself in Prague, Reseca Landau, but he was an international posek. Chubas obviously were not fast in those days, but he received questions from all over the world. And what was the question? B'mata she'ira shom be'echad shecholo b'choli ho'evin b'kiso. Regarding a patient who fell ill with a medical condition called choli ho'evin b'kiso. Now, normally when I give this lecture live, well, this is live, of course, but with an audience, I would ask, especially the medical audience or non-medical audience, if they want to hazard a guess as to what this medical condition might be. Is choli ho'evin b'kiso. So feel free if anyone wants to render a guess, I'd be delighted to entertain it. What could this condition be choli ho'evin b'kiso mean? Now, literally translated, it means a medical condition of a stone in a pocket. Now, there aren't too many stones and pockets in the body. And obviously, I'm sure a number of possibilities will come to mind for you, and we'll discuss in a moment what it must have been based on historical context. So what did the doctors do? The physicians operated on this particular medical condition, as was their medical kidney stone. We have from Dr. Kelman's. You're an honorary doctor, Rabbi Kelman. So many people say kidney stone, some say gallstone. But we'll see it's very close to kidney stone, but not exactly kidney stone, as we'll see in a few moments. So they operated on that, as was the common practice at that time. And unfortunately, tragically, the patient died. And the rabbis of London were asked, if it's permissible to perform an autopsy on this patient, the doctors approached them, because perhaps when this patient, even though this patient died, if we happen upon a similar patient, a patient with a similar medical condition, we might be able to better treat that individual. So this really was a case, seemingly, of pikuach nefesh. After all, if you glean information from this autopsy, which could be beneficial to a subsequent patient, perhaps that falls under the rubric of pikuach nefesh. The answer, which we may or may not get to this evening, of Yechezkel Landau, set the tone for the next few centuries about how we apply that principle of pikuach nefesh, its parameters, and its limitations. But before we get to the answer of Yechezkel Landau, I want to step back and ask the following question. This tshuva, written in the 1700s, mid-1700s, is the very first response in the history of Jewish literature that deals with the issue of autopsy and anatomical dissection. So my question to you is, why is it that it's only in the 1700s that we have the very first discussion of anatomical dissection? What happened to Maimonides? The Rambam lived in the 1100s. We know the Rambam was a great Talmudist. We know the Rambam was a great physician. For those of you who are unfamiliar, many of us are familiar with his halachic works. He wrote on the Mishnah. He wrote the Yad HaChazaka, you know, covering the totality of Jewish law. He also wrote numerous books on medicine, and his books were quoted extensively by his non-Jewish contemporaries. We have his medical works today. His medical works have been translated. They were written in Judeo-Arabic. They've been translated into Hebrew. They've been translated into English, and they are widely available. Yet, in his writings, not a single mention of anatomical dissection or autopsy. Zero. Why is that? Shulchan Aruch, 1500s, the body of Jewish law which we draw upon extensively every day in rabbinic discourse. Not a mention. Everything from before you wake up in the morning till after you go to sleep, from birth to death, and even after death, morning practices, exhumation. Not a single discussion. So Rabbi Kelman points out, I assume they did not exist medically. So that's precisely our issue. So why is it that they weren't being discussed? So in order to know the answer to that, we have to know the history of medicine. We have to know that indeed anatomical dissection has a varied history. So back in the times of antiquity, 2nd, 3rd century before the Common Era, there was a school of anatomical dissection in Alexandria, the same location that David Ben Zimra would practice many centuries later. People traveled from all over the world to attend that school of dissection, and it lasted from what we know. We don't have any extant material from that school, but we do know references to it subsequently. It lasted roughly a century and a half. When that school closed down, for reasons which we don't understand, there was no systematic anatomical dissection in the medical world, in medical training and practice, until the period of the early Renaissance. So we're talking a period of 1,500 years where anatomical dissection was not performed in a systematic fashion. Now, it was performed occasionally if somebody washed up from the ocean or if a criminal was sentenced to death. There would be the occasional dissection. But even Galen, who is considered one of the greats of the history of medicine, who superseded Hippocrates. Hippocrates was not one individual, but probably was a group of the writings of Hippocrates are attributed to more than one individual, was in the 5th century before the Common Era. Galen lived in, to give you a Jewish context, he was a rough contemporary of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the redactor of the Mishnah, in the second century of the Common Era. Galen, whose works were the Bible of medicine for over a millennium, never systematically dissected the human body. And his works, and he wrote extensively on anatomy and physiology, were largely based on animal dissection. As such, they were replete with multiple errors based on assumptions that the human anatomy was identical. Just to give you an idea of the perseverance of the works of Galen, just a moment ago we mentioned the great Maimonides, the great Rambam. One of the medical works of the Rambam was a commentary on the works of Galen, who preceded him by a millennium. Over 1,000 years later, the Rambam was still writing on Galen, to give you an idea of how extraordinarily important the works of Galen were in the practice of medicine. Now, Galen himself was a physician to the gladiators, so he actually may have learned a little cross-sectional anatomy, you know, by the slicing through the gladiators. But he clearly did not dissect the body in a systematic fashion. So when was it reintroduced into the practice of medicine? Now, obviously, all advances in science and medicine don't occur overnight. They are all an evolutionary process. But the crowning glory of anatomical dissection, the one who is largely credited with rediscovering or reinstituting anatomical dissection as part of medical training, is a man named Andreas Vesalius. And in a work which is considered one of the greatest in the history of science, The Fabric of the Human Body, written in Latin primarily, you have the front page of this work in the upper left-hand corner of your handout. The work itself is a very, very large book, magnificently illustrated, the first also to introduce the interface of art into the field of medical illustration, or at least to do it in such an extensive way, and the skeleton illustration that you have on the front of your handout derives from this work, The Fabric of the Human Body, by Andreas Vesalius. Just a brief tangent about the location about Andreas Vesalius. He taught at the University of Padua. The University of Padua was one of the very few universities in the Middle Ages and Renaissance that allowed Jews to attend. The practice in almost all European universities was that in order to receive a degree from the university, you have to avow your belief in Christianity. Therefore, Jewish students could simply never obtain degrees. They couldn't graduate to become physicians or even graduate universities, because in order to attain that diploma, they had to avow their belief in Christianity. The University of Padua, despite its proximity to the Catholic Church, to Rome, was an independent state and did not require any of its students to avow belief in Christianity. Therefore, many, many Jews from all over Europe attended the University of Padua. The University of Padua was no second-rate university. It was one of the greatest universities in the history of Europe. The likes of Andreas Vesalius lectured there. Galileo lectured at the University of Padua. This is the university where the Jews of the Renaissance were attending. And I actually have at home a registry of all the Jews who attended the medical school at the University of Padua from about 1200 to about 1650, and it reads like a veritable who's who of the Jewish of world Jewry from times of the Renaissance. Medical school. So it's really quite extraordinary. This is the place where Andreas Vesalius delivered his lectures. Now, the fact that there were Jews present may have influenced the fact, which is also very curious, that any famous Rabbanim, Rabbi Kelman asks. Yes, Rabbi Yitzchak Lompranti is one, the author of the Pachad Yitzchak. The Pachad Yitzchak was a, we are all familiar with the Pachad Yitzchak, the contemporary, or some may be familiar with Rav Huttner's Pachad Yitzchak. The first Pachad Yitzchak was written in the Renaissance by Rav Yitzchak Lompranti, and it was actually the very first encyclopedic work in the history of Jewish literature. It's an Aleph to Tuf serial volumed work about everything that relates to medicine, everything that relates to halacha under that particular letter. So it's the forebearer of the Encyclopedia Talmudit. He was a physician, and he graduated the University of Padua. There's also a controversial figure, Azaria de Rossi, who wrote Min HaAdumim, which is one of the first histories of the Jewish people, perhaps influenced by the Italian Renaissance, also attended the medical university of Padua. But in the very work, the classic work of the history of medicine called The Fabric of the Human Body of Andreas Vesalius, if you consult that work today, and there are still original copies from the 1500s that you can find in the great libraries in the world, I consulted the copy in the British Library, you will see that the language of translation of the anatomical terms is not only in Latin and Greek, but it is also in Hebrew. The Hebrew language appears in the classic work of Andreas Vesalius. Now, you can't see it in your handout, but in the front page, there is one figure who has a Jewish-looking appearance, who's wearing a fez, and the historians believe that this was a man named Lazarus de Phrygius, probably was called up to the Torah by Rav Lazarus. And Lazarus de Phrygius was the one purportedly who taught Vesalius this Hebrew that was incorporated into his works. Right. I see it by Kelman's, I'm talking about Azaria de Rossi.
I'm talking about the
Seda Asura, he's the one who comments on spontaneous generation. Right, he's the one who first raised this issue of science conflicting with the Gemara with respect to spontaneous generation, because he had trained in one of the greatest universities in the world, and he realized that spontaneous generation was actually no longer a current theory. So he challenged his contemporaries to address the issue in the Gemara, where it says that the kinim ain paravarava, that lice do not spontaneously generate. Now, he wrote to his Rebbe, Rav Brill, claiming that we should change the halacha, that in this particular case, the halacha would actually be lahachmir, not lakula, because the halacha is that you're allowed to kill kinim on Shabbos because they spontaneously generate. And he suggested that we be machmir because the science teaches us that they generate not spontaneously. But his Rebbe said we shouldn't change the halacha despite what the science says, and he acceded to the wishes of his Rebbe. But to return to this situation of Andreas Vesalius, so he's the one who reintroduced this notion of anatomical dissection, and that is why we don't find the Rambam discussing it, because anatomical dissection was not part of his training. That's why the Shulchan Aruch didn't discuss it, because it is only really in the 1500s beginning. Andreas Vesalius' work is in the mid-1500s. 1543, I believe, was the first edition. The Shulchan Aruch was published in the 1550s. It really only became an integral part of medical training again in the 1600s into the 1700s. So that's why Bethesda Landau is the first one to address this issue. We have in the next tshuva to illustrate this that it's a new dissection. We have a wonderful question and response by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, the Sheilas Yavetz, who is a contemporary. He was in Germany. He was a rough contemporary of Rabbi Bethesda Landau, and the question that was posed to him was from Göttingen. It's the second source in your handout on this page, from Göttingen in Germany, and Tu Bishvat, would have been not too long ago, Tafsadi Zion. Shalom v'yesha rab, l'rav safra v'tuvayin d'chakima. This is also just an excerpt of a very lengthy responsa. My Hebrew is fairly good. I don't profess to be able to read and understand the entire question. The literary capability of the questioner is quite exceptional. And this is a young man who was attending the University of Göttingen as a medical student. But what he asks, and if you skip to the underlined section, says, So he writes with Yaakov Emden, I am now a student in the 1700s, and it's relatively new that we students who are training in medicine have to practice anatomical dissection. And he continues to ask, and he says, sometimes we have to do dissection on Shabbos. Sometimes there's not a body available, we have to do dog lab, dog dissection. Can I, as a firm student, A, participate in dissection at all? B, can I participate on Shabbos? Is it pikuach nefesh? Do I have to worry about carrying a scalpel through Rosh Hashanah? Whole host of issues. And this led to a very, very lengthy response by Rav Yaakov Emden on the entire issue of anatomical dissection and the permissibility of undergoing this dissection. But it shows us that it's only in this period that the issue of dissection became relevant and first appeared really in halachic literature. We happen to know a little bit about the questioner from other sources, and if you look in the end of the of this tshuva, you'll see Ko Divrei in the bold-faced print, Ko Divrei Hashoket al Dalkei Chokmas HaRefua, Hashem HaTzoyer, Benjamin Wolf Ginsberg. So this fellow, Benjamin Wolf Ginsberg, we happen to know, the practice was in Europe, and remains in practice to this very day, that everybody who graduated medical school has to write a graduation thesis. And for his thesis, these theses, by the way, were not things which people put together in a day or two. Very many of these theses turned out to be revolutionary work in the practice of medicine. These were written by medical students and changed the course of medicine. His thesis, Benjamin Wolf Ginsberg, was on the topic of biblical and Talmudic medicine. And as far as we know in recorded literature, he's the very first person to write a history of biblical and Talmudic medicine. And you see actually a translation of the front page. We have the entire thesis. We have a copy, extant copies. It's been translated into English. On the right side, right middle of your handout, you have to the consensus, inaugural medical disputation on medicine from the Talmud to the consensus of the gracious medical faculty, etc., etc., by Benjamin Wolf Ginsberger. This is quite a remarkable thing. But just to return now, it's not available for sale, Rabbi Kelman, but there is for those who want a copy, once I unpack my library, which could take me about 6 months or so, a copy has been published in a journal called the Korot, which is published erratically these days, but for many decades was a premier journal in Jewish medical history. And they published the entire thesis in English translation. And if anyone's interested, feel free to email me. I'd be happy to furnish you a copy. So just to return to our question about what the medical condition was that the Noda Yehuda was referring to, We turn to another passage from Rav Yaakov Emden, this time not in his Tshuvos, but in his halachic work on Shulchan Aruch, called the Moruk Tzia and Hilchos Shabbos, in the bottom right-hand corner, where he writes, Aval yesh bofim besakot nefashos, kedei lehatil atzma meyisurim. The context of this is talking about the permissibility of undergoing certain surgical procedures. And he says there's certain conditions for which people undergo surgery. Reading from the second line in the middle, Ke'otzon shemosrin atzmon lachtoch b'nei even shebekis u'begid v'chatzat ha'klayot ha'koevoson ma'od b'tzar kosher kimoves rachmano l'tlan. There's a certain medical condition that Rabbi Yaakov Emden talks about. This unique medical condition causes people so much pain and so much tsar that they undergo surgery even though the surgery is extraordinarily dangerous. Now, what medical condition is he talking about? What medical condition is another Yehuda talking about? This Evan Shebekis, Choli Ha'Evan Bekiso. There's only one possibility. It's not gallstones. It's not even kidney stones, although it's in the same system. It's actually bladder stones, stones in the urinary bladder. Now today, we are very familiar with kidney stones. Kidney stones are measured in millimeters. Bladder stones are measured in inches. Bladder stones can become very, very large, and for reasons which we don't fully understand, but probably because of the of our major dietary changes beginning in the 19th century, the prevalence of bladder stones has fallen precipitously. Bladder stones used to be one of the most common medical conditions and the most common surgical condition. And in fact, cutting for the stone is one of the oldest surgeries in the history of surgery. The first century of the Common Era, 2,000 years ago, Celsus wrote a detailed description of cutting for the stone, making an incision in the perineal area near the rectum and incising and removing the stone. This was in before anesthesia and antibiotics and antisepsis. This was one of the handful of surgeries that was performed at all. Not many surgeries were performed. But it was a very risky procedure. And in fact, in the bottom of your handout, you have the famous French song, Frère Jacques, Frère Jacques. Brother Jacques, whom we all know had a religious epiphany and became a religious figure, before he was before he became a Baal Tshuva, he was a wandering lithotomist. A lithotomist is somebody who cuts for the stone. Why was he a wandering lithotomist? Because his mortality rate for the operation was over 50%. That means more than half of the people he operated on died of the operation, let alone those who had complications of the operation. Very risky operation. That's why Rav Yaakov Emden says that one is prohibited from undergoing this operation despite the extraordinary in bladder stones. And it is considered a condition of tremendous pain. Returning to this Nodeb Yehuda, if you look at the bottom left-hand side, the area of the greatest experimentation in the field of bladder stones and bladder stone surgery was in London. And you have here an excerpt from a journal from 1746 called Philosophical Transactions, which is a journal, despite the fact that it's entitled Philosophical Transactions, we won't get into this now, it was a premier medical journal. And you have to read carefully, it's actually Old English, it's a little difficult to read sometimes, but this particular case study is a remarkable case of a person cut to the stone in a new way by William Cheselden. Cheselden is a famous figure in the modern medical history. So it's quite possible that Cheselden and his team were operating in London and they were doing experimental procedures. And when it didn't work and the patient died, they wanted to do an autopsy in order to perfect their procedures. So they asked the question this is obviously speculation, but perhaps they asked this question to Yvesetka Landau, who then rendered his all-important decision. So what was his decision? And obviously, you know, as I look at my watch, I realize we're not going to get to the entire set of handouts this evening. We'll do maybe just a little bit more to close off the section of anatomy this evening. What was the reaction of Yecheskel Landau's decision? Yecheskel Landau's decision was that indeed it is permitted to perform an anatomical dissection for the sake of pikuach nefesh, but there are limitations. What are the limitations? Limitations are that you have to have a chola lefoneinu. This was his phrase, which was actually coined later on, excerpted from his works or from the Chassam Sofer's works. That in order to violate the pikuach nefesh, you have to have a patient that will directly and immediately benefit. In Mirza Hashem next week, we will talk about the halachic ramifications of that decision with organ donation and transplantation. But just to close off this evening and end the issue of anatomical dissection, we turn to the next page entitled Grave Robbing, and I'll spend just a few brief moments on that. Yes, Rabbi's, so just to clarify Rabbi Kelman's question, it is true that autopsy would, so to clarify, Rabbi Yecheskel Landau refused autopsy in that case. Autopsy was usher. Because, and thank you for allowing me to clarify, because he did not feel that this autopsy would benefit a patient immediately and directly. And consequently, most autopsies, for sure routine autopsies, would be usher according to the parameters of the Noda Behuda. If you could find a case where you have an infectious disease, let's say, you know, in the SARS epidemic that broke out in Toronto, and an autopsy might be needed to try and clarify treatment for a fatal condition, that's already a different story, and even the Chazon Ish says explicitly in times of epidemic, autopsies may be permitted. But on a routine basis, it doesn't meet the threshold of chola lefoneinu, which we will see next week. With organ donation, there is always a chola lefoneinu, and therefore, pikuach nefesh, the parameters would apply, according to the Noda Behuda. I'm sorry?
I was just going to comment that, in practice, as far as I know, even though the Noda Behuda may have allowed in certain times, he's always the basis why everybody says you can never do autopsies. The Rabbanim, and if I'm not mistaken, I heard in the name of Rabbi Tendler that in many ways that was a very tragic tshuva, because had he been alive, you know, 20 years later, he would have written a very different tshuva. And I don't know if you want to comment on that or if that's too explosive an issue.
Not at all. Actually, it's very important. And that really gets to the same issue we've been talking about this entire evening, and that's the understanding of the tshuva in its proper historical context. So to say that, the Noda Behuda forbade autopsies in his time, but the question you have to ask is, if the Noda Behuda were living today, would he forbid all autopsies? And the answer to that may not be yes. In our situation today, where we have much greater communication abilities, as evidenced by this extraordinary example this evening when we're talking live online, where surgical procedures can be instantaneously transmitted throughout the world, where information can be transmitted throughout the world, the application of his principle, chol lefoneinu, needs redefinition. It doesn't mean that his tshuva is wrong. It means that he himself would have taken the tshuva and applied it to our contemporary, perhaps differently. And while Rabbi Kelman says few rabbis are bold enough to redefine it, there are indeed a number of rabbis who have redefined the application of chol lefoneinu bizman hazeh to be more permissive in cases of autopsy. But on the flip side, we are also living in the times where one need not desecrate the body to the extent that was required in the Middle Ages to glean the information necessary. So whereas 100 years ago you'd have to do a full head-to-toe autopsy, today you can do a full-body CAT scan or full-body MRI and do a focused needle biopsy, which according to Rav Moshe wasn't even usher bichlal, and you'd circumvent the whole problem of needle amaze. Now obviously you got to find somebody to pay for those MRIs. That's an insurance issue, but it's quite remarkable, and I've suggested that in many cases that the doctors can obtain the information without performing desecration, so you really skirt the issue that way. But just to spend 5 minutes on the grave robbing issue, we now established that anatomical dissection became an integral part of medical training. What then happened, and that was somewhat similar to the mummy issue, there now overnight was a massive demand for bodies for dissection for all the medical schools, yet there weren't enough bodies to supply them. So where were all these bodies going to come from? So one of the things that was done, tragically, and we're all familiar with it probably more so from literature than from history books, is grave robbing or body snatching. That there was a black market in going to cemeteries, exhuming bodies, and delivering them to the medical schools for a handsome fee. To give you an idea of how prevalent that was, none other than William Shakespeare was concerned about this, as you see in his epitaph in the upper right-hand corner. Good friend, for God's sake forbear to dig the dust enclosed here. Blessed be ye man that spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones. So William Shakespeare was afraid that somebody would dig up his body and sell it to the medical schools. So my point here is to show you that even this had ramifications in the Jewish world and in the halakhic literature. So you have, and I'll just summarize it. You have from Cecil Roth, who was the author of the first Encyclopedia Judaica, which now is enjoying its second edition. In a history of the great synagogue, he says that the synagogue in London had to take care of its cemetery, and there were people who were robbing the graves of the Jewish cemetery. And it's interesting, the Jewish cemetery was the preferred cemetery for the grave robbers. Now, why do you think that is? Because the Jews, and we'll discuss this next week also, the Jews have an obligation to bury the body right away. So the bodies from the Jewish cemeteries were the freshest and the best for the dissection table. So they loved the Jewish cemeteries. So what they did is they established a mishmar, a shmira, from dusk to dawn. And every single member of the community had a chiyuv to go do shmira in the cemetery. And I want to point this out because I thought it was just fascinating. I was doing a Google search in the middle of the night while I was practicing emergency medicine. It was a little slow. So I Googled Jews and grave robbing. And I got, you know, thousands of things, you know, which were political, had nothing to do with medical history. But I got one hit from the library in the south of England, and it ended up being this manuscript which you have on your page over here. And what it is it's a copy of the very ticket which was issued to a member of the Great Synagogue in order that he should perform his shmira at the cemetery that night. It's a little small, but you can actually see that it's bordered by skull and crossbones. Very interesting artwork. And it says, Yechezkel ben Shlomo Schneider, Samuel Abagora Lelech Lishmor B'Vesachayim, it is now your night, that it says this specific parsha of the week, what night he has to go, and if he doesn't go, there's a huge fine that is imposed upon him if he doesn't go do his shmira signed by the treasurer of the Great Synagogue of London. So what was the halakhic solution? The halakhic solution was perhaps to delay burial or to bury people in different times. To bury people in different places. So this shaila was posed in the 19th century. And here you have an example of the shaila and chuvas of Shari Tzion. And it's actually about a case in Cincinnati, Shayla Boilani, Cincinnati, where the medical schools were digging up all the cemeteries and they couldn't control it. So they asked Shayla, the building, is it permissible to delay bury these bodies temporarily in one location and then to rebury them, reinter them later? And the fact was indeed it was permitted to do such a thing. And even the great Yitzhak Elchanan acceded to that concern as he responded to this tshuva about the permissibility. And just finally, in the very last part of your handout, another solution to this problem of grave robbing is this entrepreneurial solution, which appeared as an advertisement in the Woolers British Gazette in October 13, 1822. And I will read for you. Many hundred dead bodies will be dragged from their wooden coffins this winter for the anatomical lecturers, the articulators, and for those who deal in the dead, for the supply of the country practitioner and the Scotch schools. The question of the right to inter in iron is now decided. The violation of the sanctity of the grave is said to be needful for the instruction of the medical pupil. But let each one about to inter a mother, husband, child, or friend say, shall I devote this object of my affection to such a purpose? If not, the only safe coffin is Bridgman's patent wrought iron coffin one. Charge the same price as the wooden one. So you see here in your handout, and if you go to England, you'll see a number of these in these cemeteries, wrought iron bars on top of the cemetery to prevent the thieves from doing the grave robbing. So in conclusion, we've covered this evening as a background before we launch into the present and in the future of Jewish medical ethics. We've discussed the issues of the mumia and the issues of the anatomical dissection and grave robbing, and showed that rabbis of all generations have not only understood the contemporary medicine and science, but have applied halacha in full force to what were then pressing contemporary and important issues. And Mr. Shem, we will continue that process next week, same bat time, same bat channel, as we move into the 20th and 21st century with an extremely important topic, and that's the topic of organ donation, both from one living human being to another, and from deceased human beings. And we will be applying very practically the tshuva of the No Debi Huda, which we learned historical basis of this evening. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions by voice or by chat if there are. And I thank you all for this wonderful experience, and I look forward to continuing in Yitz Hashem in the weeks to come.
Thank you, Eddie. Esther, you have a question?
Just wanted to know, why are present-day rabbis against autopsies? I'm not sure if you mentioned that or not.
The issue of autopsy, and we'll discuss this more extensively next week, there are a number of prohibitions and obligations that relate to the body after death. There's an obligation to bury the body, as we mentioned. There's a prohibition against desecration of the body, and there's a prohibition against deriving any benefit from the human body. Those are three major prohibitions and obligations, and the only way you can supersede those is for pikuach nefesh. The bar that the No Debi Yehuda set for pikuach nefesh is that there has to be somebody who will directly benefit from that information. So when you do an autopsy, granted the information will be put in a bank and even logged in as the cause of death, but it's a stretch to say that any specific autopsy will directly lead to the assistance of any ill patient who is currently in a hospital at that time.
That might have been true 20 years ago, but you know better than I that in today's medical world, everything works by accumulating things in the bank. And if I'm not mistaken, Rav Unterman allowed a skin bank before some of the wars in Israel, because even though they didn't have anybody, they knew there'd be a situation. One could argue that there's none of them, maybe the entire basis of the No Debi Yehuda is no longer applicable. And I'm not aware. Are you aware of any major question? I doubted. Are there any question who really say that that principle, everything is manada, is the Kameinu? And if not, I'm curious. I would think that's not a stretch of an argument anymore.
The point is very well taken. The thing you have to worry about, Rabbi Kelman, is the, and it's Effie, is that, are you the one who addressed
yeah.
the question? Slope concept. And even the No Debi Yehuda himself alluded to this concept. And if one would extend the principle very broadly, as Rabbi Kelman is suggesting, then one could argue that every single human being who ever dies should be dissected, and in essence you'd be eliminating the whole notion of Nivul Ames and Hanas Ames from the Torah. So while it's true the parameters should be extended beyond the original the tshuva of the No Debi Yehuda, to extend it to the extent where all autopsies should be done on everybody because of accumulation of statistics, I think that is pushing it too far. So I think you have to strike a balance between between those two.
I don't disagree. I'm just wondering where you draw the line, or I guess that's the issue.
That redefinition is the challenge of posting more acutely in the field of medicine and halakha than any other halakhic field. Lines are constantly having to be redrawn. Some poskim are very hesitant to redraw any lines, and live with the artwork of the Renaissance. And others are constantly redrawing and reconfiguring. And I think you and I, Rabbi Kelman, are in the reconfiguration camp. But again, all within the parameters of the halakhic framework. But clearly integrating the science of the times in order to be able to move forward and apply the halacha in an intellectually honest way.
Okay, I hope you had an easy fast, you know, by the way. And also, I want to wish your father-in-law a happy 80th birthday. It's famous, you see.
Oh,
and,
I see you heard about that, yeah.
He doesn't know me. I never took classics with YU, but anyway.
Hi.
I'm not sure, but anyway.
Well, thank you all very much. Seeing you all next week.
Okay, very good. Have a good night.
You too. Thank you so much.
Shalom, you here?
Yeah, I'm in the background.
Rabbi Kelman, I don't mind giving, can you hear me yet?
I do hear you.
Mr. Reiflin, if it's okay with you, can we stay on just for a few more minutes?
Absolutely, let's play.
So my question, and I just posted up is, was there any recent case of Jewish autopsy? I'm not sure if you heard me. I just asked if there's been any recent cases of Jewish autopsy where it wasn't for the benefit of others. Before, you mentioned that autopsy in Judaism is really it's for pikuach nefesh of other people. So I have heard of cases of autopsy within the Jewish communities. So are they all for pikuach nefesh, or are there other issues, or are there other circumstances where they have been permitted?
I can't comment on any specific case. I don't know which cases you're referring to, but I know, in the past, all we have is the responsa literature. So many of these cases that are passing on a case-by-case basis, nobody's ever publishing those. But I know of a number of cases where autopsy has indeed been permitted in the Jewish community over the last decade or two. And all of those have been justified in some way, shape, or form, using the principles of the Noda B'Yehuda, perhaps expanding them, as Rabbi Kelman has suggested. But they are all, there has to be some aspect of pikuach nefesh to allow the autopsy. Otherwise, there are prohibitions or isurim that are involved, which can't otherwise be waived.
Just one last thing. When you do an autopsy, are you, and you remove all the organs and you do all the investigation that you want to do, do you put all the organs back and then at the end, are you able to now bury this body as a whole?
The answer is that if an autopsy is permitted according to Jewish law, it should be done as a surgical procedure. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to view autopsies. It's a pretty crass thing without much respect to the human body. So the poskim that allow for autopsy, preferably somebody from the Jewish community should be present to monitor. part of the procedure, if at all possible. But at the very least, to have a trustworthy pathologist who will give respect to the body. And yes, all organs that are not used should be buried with the individual. And you allude to another issue which people address in the field of organ donation about whether bodies should be buried whole, whether the obligation to bury whole precludes organ donation. If you'll remind me next week when we talk about this topic, we'll discuss it a little more extensively, because it obviously bears even more so on organ donation, because you're giving that organ to somebody else and it's not going to be returned to your body after death.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, Eddie, have a good night.
You too. Thanks very much, Jay. Great.
All right.
We'll see you next week.